Welcome to the Blazing Ember podcast, where we aim to amplify the voices of Latino professionals. We, Diana and Maria, founded this podcast to explore unspoken rules and all the ships, leadership, mentorship, sponsorship, and allyship with Latino leaders.
We are here to ignite your path to success with valuable insights. Bienvenidos.
Hello. Today, we are honored to talk with the remarkable Mo Vella on our podcast. And if you don't know him, you will know why we are saying he's remarkable. He has a career that spans business, law, and politics. He has so many accomplishments that I don't think we have time to list them all, but we're going to tell you a little bit about him. And we're going to have him tell us about his amazing journey and how he's intersected all these very difficult areas, right? Even on their own, but much less intersected them. Look him up, people. Look him up. And here's a little bit of his bio. I'll give you a little bit. So he's a CEO, founder, and he's a TV star who has globally reached across various sectors and industries. He's the CEO of Mo Vella LLC. It's a strategic business advisory firm with business partnerships and venture that span the globe across a diversity of sectors, industries. He's also founder of the Vella Group, LLC. He's also of counsel, senior advisor at Stein, Mitchell, Beto, and Misner Law Firm. Additionally, like that's not enough, right? Let's talk about balance. We'll talk about that too. He co-created, co-produced, and co-starred in the business reality series, Unicorn Hunters, which also includes people like Lance Bass and Steve Wozniak. And Unicorn Hunters is really like a Shark Tank, but it's a unique concept in that these experts kind of give advice and they ask questions. And the person who's pitching gets the opportunity to have the audience invest in their solutions, their products, their services. So we're going to talk about that more in part two. And I'm telling you now, we're going to have a part two. Make sure you listen to this one first, and then we're going to come to the part two. And so we'll talk about Unicorn Hunters now. So now we're going to talk a little bit about, and this is like a great time to do this, right? Your Washington insider experience. So Mo, for those of you who know, is a true Washingtonian via Texas. We'll talk about that too. He served in the White House twice, first as a director of administration and senior advisor for then Vice President Joe Biden, who's our current president, and previously as chief financial officer and senior advisor on Hispanic affairs for Vice President Al Gore. And you're thinking, oh, okay, that's fascinating. But even more than that is that he was the first Hispanic American, Latino, and LGBTQA American to hold these senior executives in the White House, which is a record, right? And we'll talk about that too. So now, I have to take a deep breath.
Marie, I think you forgot something. I'm sure Mo invented how to get 36 hours in one day. And that we're going to have to figure it out at some point, right?
We definitely are.
Oh my God. People are going to be so disappointed because you built it up and then it's like, he wasn't that remarkable.
No, I think you are. But anyway, we're all good. We got most of this. Again, look him up. Mo, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about young Mo Vella growing up in Texas and Tejas and becoming adult Mo? I think you want to call you Joe. I don't.
It's okay. When you put Joe Biden in a previous paragraph and then it's Mo, it's like very easy to do. You're not the first that's done that, actually, believe it or not.
I'm not.
So, you know, I grew up in what I call like an incredible blessing because as a Latino, in my opinion, I'm sorry if I offend anybody that's not Hispanic, but our culture is, if not the best, one of the greatest in the world. And so I consider being Latino one of the most beautiful gifts I ever received. And so my parents just really believed in keeping our culture an important and integral part of our upbringing. So from very young age, we, you know, pastorcitos, I mean, we did everything from the posadas right, to everything. What do you call it? Cascarones. I mean, you know, so to us, it was like a beautiful upbringing. And so I want to start with the positive about it, which was unconditional loving parents, amazing siblings, and an environment, frankly, where my dad was an attorney and later became the county judge. My uncle was one of the first five Hispanic federal judges in the history of the United States. The federal courthouse in Brownsville, Texas is named Vela after my uncle. And so just to put it in context, it was, you know, I'm blessed. We'd sit around the table and talk about where we were going to college, not whether we were going. And I consider that a gift and a blessing. You know what I'm saying? Because so many young people, not just Hispanics, but a lot of young folks don't have that luxury of expectation and support and parents and families that believe in you. Now, that's all the beauty and the good. And as you guys already know from a previous conversation we had off the record, I don't have a filter. And I also believe in living authentically and telling the truth. And I'm very proud to have served my country and have made a little bitty, itty bitty slice of American history, hopefully open some new doors for Latinos behind me, hopefully, you know, scattered some or broke some glass ceilings for LGBTQA behind me. All that's fantastic. But I think too often we talk about people's accomplishments and we don't talk about their challenges. And so my childhood was not without trauma. And I'm very open about this because I think too often we just focus on people's accomplishments and their successes, and we don't talk about the humanity of the journey of life. And so I'm sorry to be so long-winded. Let me quickly go through a little bit of the trauma.
No, by all means, please.
So at 7 years of age, Maria Indiana, I wrestled with my best friend Greg next door. And this is all in my autobiography, by the way, called Little Secret, Big Dreams. So it's not like I'm revealing any secrets. I have told the world this already, but
we'll find a secret for you to reveal at some point.
Oh, if there's two people that could do it, it's probably the two of you. and knowing me, I'll tell the secret. So don't worry. If you find it, I'll tell it. Don't worry. But, you know, 7 years old, I wrestle with my best friend, Greg, next door. He's also seven. And I describe it in my book that I really went to bed that night at 7 years old. It's hard to believe. 1968, Texas, Catholic, Latino, the son of the judge, right? Mom's a teacher, respected in the community. And I knew already that night, I cried myself to sleep because I knew that wrestling with Greg was better than ice cream. And that little moment triggered in my mind, I couldn't say it. I couldn't be it. I couldn't express it. I couldn't live it. And there began that little secret that frankly almost destroyed me, literally. So, you know, I lived with that until about 11 and a half. The anxiety was percolating, right? And so for 4 years or so, it was hard for me to stay in school, for example, because the anxiety would, you know, erupt. And by fourth grade, 11 and a half, every day I'd last maybe 2 hours, and the teacher and the principal would call and say, "Judge, Mrs. Vela, you need to come get Mo Jr. He is having an emotional breakdown." And my parents were just helpless, at wit's end. I could not verbalize why I was suffering. And I had to suffer alone and in silence. And finally, my parents did what I think any parents would do, right? Or I hope that they would do, let's put it that way. They went and sought medical and expertise, professional help. And our pediatrician had become, of all things, a child psychiatrist, would be my luck. Yeah, unfortunately, I remembered as if it was today. And every time I tell the story, I get choked up still because it is very real. But the judge was on my right. My mom was on my left. Dr. Williford was across the desk. And I remember him looking at my parents and saying, and the last thing the doctor wanted to do was disappoint the judge. And you as attorneys, I think, can really appreciate that reverence, if you will, that people have for judges. And I remember him saying, Judge Mrs. Vella Mo Jr. has a mental illness.
Oh.
I'm 11 and a half. And I hear him say to my parents, he's mentally ill.
And you're sitting there hearing this.
Yana, I am sitting there. Fine. Yeah, they were talking as if I wasn't in the room. You know, and this is where began this premise for me in my life. Words matter.
Yes. Yes.
Words matter. Yes. And so I remember my dad saying, well, doctor, and mom, of course, tearing up and saying, what can we do to help him? What does he have? Well, 1972, Texas. He didn't say, right? The last thing that Dr. Williford is going to diagnose is homosexuality.
Right.
Right. Stonewall had just happened 4 years before. It is Texas, right? It's the Wild West. It's still the cowboys and the Latino machismo and, you know, the Catholicism. I mean, you just put it all in. And yeah. It was what I call in my book, The Perfect Storm. Yeah. So the doctor makes up a diagnosis and he says, Mo Jr. suffers from separation anxiety. That's why he can't stay in school. And my parents said, well, is there a cure? And he said, oh, there is. Absolutely. And I'm prepared to tell you what it is. And if you will prove it, I will execute. And I'm listening to all this. And the doctor's diagnosis and solution was to take me away from my family.
Oh.
Yes. Jeez. I was taken from my family and shipped away.
To further trigger the separation anxiety.
Yana, imagine as if the trauma that I was already experiencing was not enough. They take me away for 6 hours away to Austin, Texas, and put me in a mental hospital.
Oh my God.
I'm on a children's wing, and the adults are on the same damn floor, but in this, across the hall.
Right.
And every morning, my recollection from 11 and a half years of age to 12 was looking down at the end of the hallway and watching adults getting electric shock treatment through a window.
Oh my God.
Yep. And I'm there for 6 months. And then Dr. Williford calls the judge and says, Mo Jr. is cured. And every time I give this in a speech or anywhere I speak, somebody will always raise their hand. They're just so shaken by the story. And they'll raise their hand and go, what do you mean by cured, right? And I go, I should have won an Academy Award. That's what cured was. I learned how to compartmentalize. And I learned how to keep this anxiety in a place where I could still survive.
Out of that environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's so what it took to get out of there.
Yeah. Came back to the Rio Grande Valley down on the frontera where I grew up in Harlingen, Texas, and right along the Mexican border. And I did what, frankly, a lot of people that are listening and watching your podcast have had to do in their lives. You do what you've got to do to survive, whether it's an immigrant Absolutely. Who comes across the river and comes and finds whatever job they have to feed their children.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, why I'm so passionate about advocacy for anybody that's marginalized, anybody yeah. who feels disenfranchised, whether it be gender, immigration, whether it be a woman who is fighting to make choices of her body, whatever the cause is, if I feel somebody's marginalized, oh my God, I get all the pasión del Latino, my blood starts boiling. Yeah. But anyway, I went back, became an all-star football player, avid fisherman, incredible marksman in hunting. I did everything a Texas boy was supposed to do, and I did it well, very well.
Wow.
Was there a moment in those 6 months that like you learned, you figured out that this is what you had to do to be able to just be able to move forward, that you had to somehow make yourself fit into the society yeah. box?
Yeah. You know, nobody's ever asked me that question in 30 years.
There you
years.
Go.
Oh.
And you know what? It's a brilliant, insightful question. The answer is absolutely yes. Like I think, Diana, I remember vividly in those 6 months, first of all, feeling so isolated and so alone and so scared, right? Just it's a profound feeling. But I do remember what you're asking, thinking to myself, either I do what I have to do to fit in, or I'm in here the rest of my life.
Because they don't know what to do with
it. No, exactly. In my little young mind, it was, I'm either here, right? or I got to go do what I got to do. And so I did what I had to do to answer your question. And nobody's ever asked me that question that way. And I think it's a brilliant question because it's, I think, like I said earlier, millions of people have to do this in different circumstances on their journey. I'm not the only one. I'm not unique. No. My story's not special. My story's not anything than anybody else's. I have never, ever felt that way. And I'm very, very strict about saying that when I share the story, because I don't want anybody to think that their trauma is any worse or better or different than mine. Trauma is trauma. It knows no color. It knows no age. It knows no discrimination.
And that's what
I learned that lesson, you know, but I'll end the whole upbringing story with one last piece of the puzzle. Played football, did all the sports, did everything, hunting, fishing, did everything, was the kind of the ideal Texas boy, raised cattle for the livestock show. I mean,
I love it.
I like how they think I was straight, but I won the showmanship trophy. It was this big trophy. And I'm like, I'm sure I remember receiving it thinking, they think I'm straight. What straight boy wins the showmanship? You know, here's the best.
That's so funny.
A little Broadway show, you know?
That's so funny.
It was very foreshadowing, but still growing, still blossoming, still evolving. And by 17, the locker room, not for the reasons everyone thinks, sexual and nudity. No, it wasn't any, are you kidding? I was too scared to even look at another boy in the locker room. But the locker room epitomized and it heightened in my soul. I'm different and I can't be in here. I don't belong in here.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain, but it was this feeling of, you know, I don't belong here. And I quit football. And you guys, I can't even tell you how horrible the next 4 months of my life were. I will say the worst 4 months of my whole 62 years of this journey were those following 4 months. Because my four best friends that played football with me since we were 7 years old in peewee football, so they decided to pick this issue. And starting the day after I quit football, they followed me between all of my classes for 4 months and called me a faggot and a joto.
Oh.
And joto, for people that don't know, in Tejano Spanish is a fag. Pato in Puerto Rico, yes. Maricón in other cultures. But for 4 months, they followed me between classes. And
that's awful.
In my mind, in my vulnerable state, it was a form of outing me, even though they had no basis. They had no factual basis.
But they're like, something's wrong.
And they just deduced, like, that has to be the reason. Yeah.
Right. Why else would he leave football?
Exactly. Exactly. Especially since I excelled at it. And they did that for 4 months. And about the fourth month, I went home to my father's hunting cabinet and I pulled out a pistol and I went to the garage. And inevitably, in my speeches, people always ask me, were you distraught? Were you crying? Were you screaming when you were going to take your life? And I said, no, I wasn't. Ironically, I was at peace.
You were ready.
I was ready. Exactly. And I literally, in my mind, I came to the conclusion that, you know what? It's okay. This journey, this one will end. And somehow I just believed there would be another one. I really did.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, that's what they taught us, right? You come back.
Exactly. So I was just like, well,
good, you come back.
I'll come back and it certainly can't be worse than this. That was my thought process. But I was not sad. I was sad because of my mom. For some reason, that was the only thing that brought me some sadness at that moment was my mom and that how much she would suffer by me going. But when I was going to pull the trigger, the last thought I had was, if I do this, I'll never know why I was put here.
Oh my gosh.
And that saved my life. That's why I'm here on this podcast today, because the question of purpose is what kept me here.
That's awesome.
I decided I want to freaking find out why I'm here, right? I mean, then I went on to make American history. And that's why I share the story, because I want every little immigrante child who right now is sitting somewhere barely speaking English, whose parents are being ostracized by the Donald Trumps of the world and the MAGA people.
Yep.
And not just in our country, in lots of countries, immigrants and refugees are being treated with disgust and disrespect. And so I just want every kid to know it doesn't matter what your challenge is and what why you feel marginalized. It's important for each of them to understand that every single one of us is worthy of a place at the table of life. That is my favorite mantra of my journey, that every human is, with the exceptions of those that are destructive or, you know, not conducive or contributing to society in a healthy and sane and good way. But every child out there is worthy of a place at the table of life. And I want them to know, don't give up, right? We cannot give up. Yeah. It's not just surviving. It's about thriving,
yeah.
You know? And you yeah. two very successful, brilliant Latinas, I mean, you're perfect examples of the word thriving, right? Because you're at the top of your game in your respective careers, your moms, your wives, right? Your tías probably, you know, one day, God willing, you'll be abuelitas. You know, talk about thriving. You're, you know, and so I want to use my story to also focus on you guys, on the two of you and your success and the example that you are. Both of you and the role models you are.
Thank you so much.
For so many people, you know?
So I think I cry in too many of our podcasts, or at least my eyes water up way too often. At least in half of them, I get overwhelmed by the story. And yours by far is probably one of the most emotionally triggering of all the stories we've covered. And so thank you, first of all, for being so vulnerable and open about your story. And I think I pick up two things, right? Is just one, in your situation, the kind of other people that we've talked to, and this is just real straight up talk, that the decision to take an action that is life changing, mm-hmm. you know, or career changing, or just path changing,
yep.
is there's just this moment, right? And that's why I asked it, is because I've seen this pattern over and over now in yeah. the people that we've interviewed that are just amazing leaders and again, like top of their game and you know, Machiavellian in so many different ways. There's just this point where they question something, they think of something, they say, this is not it. There's more to me.
Yeah, there's gotta
there's
be more. Yeah.
More to my life than this.
Yeah.
And I think that really, as you say, right, to the it speaks to, I think, not only marginalized people, but anybody, right? Yeah. Where you it's just the human nature to say, I want to do something else with my life, and what it is not now. And I'm gonna do something that's gonna change the path of my life forever. And I think that's what's really so empowering about what I hope is so empowering about our podcast is to hear that. You know, all the people that we've interviewed at some point were just what you would call an average person, right? Who didn't have a path, who maybe didn't even know what their path in life was.
Yeah.
Their purpose. Their purpose. And somewhere they found it, or they're still finding it, to be yeah. honest, right?
They're well, I think it's an ongoing, don't you think it's a lifelong discovery? At least yeah. For me, it is, right? Because
yeah.
even at 62, I'll be 63 in October. Now, that was both of your chance to go, you don't look a day over 50. And neither of you said it, lady.
I don't like interrupting.
I'm Miho. We've already figured that out. That's why you're here. Because if we thought you were 63, we would. No, I'm kidding. Kidding, people. I'm not ages. Kidding.
Just being Chief Lotto. All joking. But, you know, even at 62, I was just having this conversation yesterday with somebody. I'm like, I'm amazed if you asked me 8 years ago on certain topics how I've evolved just in the last 8 to 10 years. Just our perspectives change, I think, because our life experiences continue to occur. And as our life experiences occur, it right. changes our kind of our insight and our perspective and our maybe our feeling right about it or our emotional attachment to certain things. Anyway, Diana, I didn't mean to cut you off. You were saying that one of the two things that you thought came out of it was that, which, by the way, I want to add the word courage to what you were saying, because I think it takes courage, right? At when you're ready at that inflection point that you're speaking of and saying, I want to know my purpose. I want to know, right? I know there's more to this and I need to discover what that is. And that takes some courage because it's scary at times.
Yes. And I think the other one is somehow in the depths of trauma or bad situation that you find yourself in, you spin that out into resilience, right? And I think that's the other thing that I admire about your story and kind of some of the turning points that I've heard is just like, it seems like, you know, you're just clouded and you got all these shadows around you and somehow some people manage to pick themselves up out of that situation. And that is no easy feat. Right. And that's why I'm always curious about like, what did it? Like, what was it? What voice inside you just
what triggered that? Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's a great point too. And, you know, honestly, there have been numerous of those moments and I this sounds so self-serving and it's so not me, but it's a running joke. So I have to tell it. But now I tell everyone that when I say that I keep saying moments and you say moments, I would say you do know that's spelled M-O-E-M-E-N-T-S from now on.
That's a good one. I love it. Yes.
But anyway, you know, there have been numerous of those moments.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like people often ask me, like, when was that major big earthquake moment? Right, where I came home from that moment and looked in the mirror and said, never again will I allow anybody to treat me with anything less than respect, dignity, right? And if you're not going to do that, you're going to hear from me and I'm not going to let you get away with it. And for me, that was when I, in my book, I call my Al Gore moment when I was the financial officer. Yeah. It was my Al Gore moment. And everyone was like, Al Gore. And I'm like, yeah, when I was his CFO and senior advisor, I was dating who today is still my best friend. We were together for 13 years. We've not been romantically together for about 13 years now as well, but we're family, we're familia. And Dave was my partner at that time. He was in the United States Navy and he was assigned to the National Security Agency. Mm. You can imagine where I'm going with this.
Yes.
He moves in with me. I buy my first little casita outside of DC in Maryland. And the National Security Agency, we all know, that and the CIA are our two major intelligence agencies. And Dave is assigned there as a Navy personnel. And he is a linguist. And that's all I'm going to say. I think the audience can figure out the rest.
Right.
When you're an expert in another foreign country's language,
yes.
Right.
Yeah, they can't see you wink, Mo.
Oh, they can't see me wink.
Wink, wink, people. Wink,
no, but the two of you can. Oh, I wore this beautiful shirt for nothing. Oh my God.
For us.
So Dave comes home one day from NSA, and because of the nature of his intelligence work, he could not speak to me about what he did at work every day.
No.
Ironically, I had top secret clearance in the White House. I couldn't tell him what I did that day.
Love it.
So it was a very interesting dynamic. And we have really abided by this. I mean, we were very strict about it. Never discussed it. But this day he came on pálido, pálido, pálido. I mean, he's already a very, very light-skinned gringo to begin with. And he was even more pálido. And I said,
so pálido is pale for our non.
Pale. I'm so sorry for non.
No, it's so he became translucent.
Yes. Very pale. And I said, what's wrong? What happened? And he looked at me and he said, I was called into a skiff. A skiff is a secure room that is used to discuss security matters that are not allowed to be spoken up outside that secure room. And he said, I was called into the skiff today and they played a video of me and you kissing through the window of our home. And they told him, under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we are going to kick you out of the United States Navy. You will be dishonorably discharged. Dishonorably discharged. And I fell to the ground.
That's.
And it was just like a kick in the gut. I was gutted. I just was gutted.
Yeah.
I cried. I yelled. I felt violated. Somebody videotaping through the window of my home.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I felt horrible for my partner. There was everything about it was just another trauma.
It was vile.
And I didn't sleep all night, and I caught the first subway train that morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. I think it starts at 5:30. I went into the White House, and I literally sat in the West Wing outside of the vice president's office waiting for him to arrive, which is completely unacceptable. Like, you don't do that.
Right. It doesn't seem.
I know. And I was distraught, and I was like, I have to resign. So I waited for him, and God love Al Gore. He saw me crying. He immediately said, come in.
Yeah, what's going on?
What's the matter? And I sat across from him at his desk in the West Wing, and I told him what happened. And this is when I cry. The vice president got up from his desk, and he came around, and he sat next to me, and he held me in his arms. Oh. And he refused to accept my resignation.
Oh.
Yep. And he said, Tipper and I love you. We respect you. We see you, and we celebrate you. And I will never forget those four phrases. That was my Al Gore moment. And wow. I left. He would not accept my resignation, so I didn't resign. And if anything, he called the Pentagon, made sure that Dave was assigned a credible JAG to represent him. And sure enough, we won the case, and he got an honorable. He was kicked out. And he only got 50% of his pension that he had put in for 13 years.
Oh.
But he was honorably discharged. And he's now a disabled veteran. And he works for the Vela Group, one of my companies. And he's familia to me. And he came home when he got his little 50% pension. And he handed me the check. And that's how I paid off my law school loans.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But Al Gore and Tipper Gore would not accept my resignation. And you, to ladies, I'm telling you, Diana, to your question, that was the moment. From that moment to this moment right this second, I have never doubted that I am worthy of love and respect. Because if the vice president of the United States can do it, then damn it, so can everybody else.
Everybody else, absolutely.
And I've never allowed, people always ask me if you've been discriminated against as a Latino or a gay. Never. And they're like, how could that be? Because I use my body language. I use my tone. I use my self-confidence. I use my self-worth. I understand my value. And you will feel that when you're talking to me. And if you think you're going to come discriminate against me, good luck.
Right.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Because we can stop it by the way we present ourselves. Very important message to your audience, I hope.
No, that's true. That's true. And I again, it's fascinating to me. And they, you know, they do studies about this, about the difference between someone who, you know, stands up straight and somebody who stands up hunched over.
Yep.
And your body, right, changes even the way you
absolutely are.
Because if you feel secure in yourself and, you know, your shoulders back.
Oh,
and straight.
No.
There is just something that chemically happens to your body, to your
absolutely
brain. Absolutely.
And I think it's an energy, Diana, that we put out.
Yes.
And people receive that energy. Like, absolutely. Like you, like the two of you are chingonas, as we say in Texas, right? And, you know, so I can already picture it. When you walk into a meeting in your respective law practices or your careers and how you're using your law degrees, I can just tell. Look
they
how
were there.
You're poised. You're both poised. You're very composed. You're very consistent. You're in control. And when we present ourselves that way, believe me, it puts people on notice.
It does.
You know?
But to be honest with whoever listens to this, it wasn't always like that for me, right? And
I don't think it was like that for any of us, right?
Right. There's a moment when you say, this is what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Yeah, you're preaching as a counter to the imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah.
Because the imposter syndrome is used against us to not have that. Right.
That's right.
I can't remember who has said, there's someone famous who said, you know, if there isn't a chair at the table, bring a chair in with you. And I bring my own chair. And that is something you have to get to. And I also want to, I want to spend a minute with our listeners talking about, I mean, your experience is unfortunate. And as you've mentioned, it happens to many people. And I think as adults, particularly as Latinos, right, where there is a certain level of, I'll say bias towards being different also in our own culture, right? I mean, that's the reality that we need to be able to be open to ensure our children know, to ensure our nieces and nephews know, and everyone around us know that we are here for them no matter what.
Exactly. Unconditional love.
Unconditional.
Absolutely. And listen, it's across the board. Right. Mm-hmm. It's not any one topic. It's like, you know, I just, to your point, I am so glad you just shared that, because I think that is until I take my last breath, I hope that that's something that I will always be advocating for, and that I'll always be sharing with every, on the bus, on the train, on the plane. I, as you can imagine from this podcast, you can already tell, I just share and talk, because to me, it's about humanity and connectivity.
Yes, mm-hmm. and words.
You know, and words matter. To make a difference. But you're so right, Maria, because I mean, kids need to know that we're not going to abandon them, right? And for no reason, right?
No reason.
That they're, you know, I think the key, you know, people always ask me, do you resent your parents for taking you to Dr. Williford that day? Do you resent them for letting them take you away? And I never, ever, for one minute of my life, have resented any of that against my parents. And, you know, my mom is still with us, as we talked about,
yes.
You know,
yes.
91 years old. And in fact, everybody say a little prayer for her. She got COVID. She sounded good this morning, but 91 and still that typical Latina, right, of that generation, just as strong as ever. And she said, don't worry, mijito, I made atole con arroz this morning. And I said, she's fine. She's going to be okay. She's like,
I love it.
She's still in the, she lives alone. And anyway, but you know, I wanted to say one other thing before we leave this topic of our culture as Latinos and Latinas and this self-image and this self-worth and the value, the self-value. I often give a talk on this to Latino audiences when I get the privilege of doing it, especially university students. Because what I remind the Latino millennials and Gen Zs and high schoolers too, is that culturally, we are taught as a cultural tradition to be really, really in touch with humility.
Yes.
And any type of any phrase that makes it sound like we are bragging or promoting ourselves or making it sound like we're really amazing, it feels violative. And arrogante, arrogant, for those who don't speak Spanish. And so it's, I don't know about y'all, but like, I literally, my mom sits on my shoulder still, and I can just hear her, honey, no digas eso, don't say that. That's very, very arrogant, right? And so, like, just you hear me a while ago, I said, this is going to sound way too self-serving.
A moment.
That's my mother.
Yeah.
That's mom, okay? But what I tell young Latino and Latina professionals and those that have yet finished college or gone to college or don't go to college, whatever, we must learn it's not arrogant to walk into a job interview or any presentation or any conversation and not roll your shoulders back, like Diana said. Be confident. Know we belong. Know you are special. You know you're uniquely, perfectly imperfect. And that's okay, right? And I just tell them, please, you can't do this because unfortunately, the non-Hispanic that follows you comes in and says, you know what, Mr. Johnson, let me tell you exactly why you need to hire me.
Yep.
Because I was first in my class, off of federal, I was on the law review. Right? And then the Latinos, they're going, I'm just grateful for the chance to speak with you.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you for the opportunity.
That's our culture.
Like you haven't earned the seat, right?
Right. I love our culture, but our culture is tainted with just a terrible history of colonization, and the words continue. Like, I don't know, for my Colombians here, like, right, the word sumerced, like, whatever sumerced, whatever you at your mercy. Speak to you, whatever you want is followed by at your mercy. And that's like that is not uncommon respectful language that people still do. So you're, you know, as a courtesy, and nobody can see my air quotes, but I'm air quoting this courtesy word, as a courtesy in your day-to-day interaction, people who, you know, who believe they are less than you or serving you will say at your mercy. When it just, now we're all equals, you know, we're all
exactly
equal and deserving of respect.
Those job interviews are what make me the most upset for our culture and our community. Because you know that they're in there going, oh, thank you. Like Maria said, thank you for the opportunity. I mean, that was me with Ron Klain when I got called to interview for the Al Gore job. I literally walked in and he was in Teddy Roosevelt's office, for God's sake. What bald gay?
Yeah, like,
I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, what little gay?
Yeah. You're like, I'm in the room.
Gonna go
I'm
to
in the
Teddy room. Roosevelt's office.
So before we go, you gave us a preview of your White House experience, right? And I thank you again for your
Well, that was the personal and the journey.
The personal journey,
yes.
Right? And now I kind of want to shift a little bit to your career and tell us, you know, how is it exactly that you ended up one day and, you know, with Al Gore in a room crying, unfortunately, right? But what, you know, there was a lot that happened between the bow of 17 years old and having all these, you know,
and almost taking my life. Thoughts. Yeah. How do you go from that to, Well, I'm glad you asked it that way, by the way, because it allows me to tell the story is kind of, it's actually somewhat humorous, but it's also very indicative that in life, I think we just have to remain flexible, adaptable, and open to the universe. Whether you're religious and you consider it's the Lord or God or Buddha or Muhammad or whatever your beliefs are. But I just think what I learned is just remain open and ready and flexible, right? To pivot. Because I had been appointed by the Clinton White House, listen to this, to the Department of Agriculture.
They knew about your trophy.
Swear to God, they put the gay bald Latino from South Texas on agriculture. And
well,
I'm like,
because okay, you raised those cows.
I know what I'm
saying. That's what I'm saying.
It was just.
You're from Texas. Perfect.
It was, let me tell you why they did it. As we say in Spanish, no se me prendió el foco. I had not had the light bulb moment to realize it until I got to DC and I go to work for the first day. I'm in congressional relations. And then I had an aha moment on my first day. Oh, for God's sakes, my tío, Kika de la Garza, my uncle, was the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee in the Congress. Let's put the nephew at congressional relations so the chairman gives us our budget.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
I didn't get it. I was, that's how naive I was. I was 32, 31 maybe. And first call I get from the Secretary of Agriculture, Mike Espy at the time. He says, I need you to go meet with the chairman with me. And then I realized, oh my God. And sure enough, we go in to see my tío Kika de la Garza and the chairman and the secretary's here. And I'm like, just as, you know, like a little mouse. It's hard to believe I can become a mouse, but I can. And I was just sitting there just so in awe that I was in this meeting. And my tío Kika had the biggest, heaviest Mexican border accent you've ever heard. And he goes like this, Mr. Secretary, if you think bringing Mo Jr. to the meeting is going to help you get money, you're wrong, he tells me.
Oh, hysterical.
All the blood left my head. And I'm like, I'm going to get fired on my second week.
But you got like, even talk to your uncle?
And I'm like, Yo-Kika. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get fired. But then I lasted like 2.5 years. And then one night a bunch of Clinton appointees at other federal agencies. We all met for beer one night and we're at sitting out having beer. Well, I guess we had all had just a few too many, if you will. And this young lady named Paula Thomason from Arkansas, where the Clintons were from, just with her Arkansas accent, she just says after a few beers, my Aunt Patsy says Al Gore's office is looking for some help. They need a lawyer type.
What does that mean?
Exactly. And I had had three or four beers. So I was like, Paula, I'm a lawyer type.
Lawyer type.
What do you mean by lawyer type? She said, I go, I'm licensed, but I don't practice. You know? So I said, that makes me a lawyer type?
Yeah, right.
And she said, I think it does. So she said, send me your resume when you get home. And Patsy Thomason was the director of administration for the Clinton White House because she grew up with Bill Clinton in Hope, Arkansas. They had been friends since kindergarten. So wow. She managed the White House personnel and administration. And so I send her my resume at midnight. And the next day I get a phone call at probably 10:30 in the morning. And the man says, may I speak to Mo Vella? I said, this is he. And he says, this is Ron Klain. Well, if you think for a second, Ron Klain just finished being chief of staff to Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. Yep.
Ron Klain was Al Gore's chief of staff.
Yep.
And he says, can you come meet with me at 4:00? I said, today? And he's like, yes, today. And I said, of course. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'll be right there. Little did I know we're 1 week apart. I'm there. Yes, sir. Speaking of the Latino thing.
Yep.
See, I was just like the whole way. I was just like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I'm just so, you know what I'm saying? Oh, my God. I'm just so grateful.
Yeah.
Right. For this opportunity. And that was it. I walked into Teddy Roosevelt's office. I was scared to death. He shut this big 12-foot wooden ornate door with carvings on it with a brass handle. And we sit in there and Ron Klain, we talk and we get to know each other a little bit. And he said, yeah, I'm looking for a lawyer type because this is one of my favorite stories that I don't get to tell very often. He literally said, this is somewhat covert. Well, I was so naive. I thought, oh my God, they're going to kill me when I'm done. It's covert. I'd only seen movies. Can you imagine? And I'm sitting there going, am I prepared to die for my nation? This is horrible. And I said,
the line of fire.
Swear to God. And to this day, Ron and I are like brothers. And he still laughs about it because he says, I looked at him and go, Mr. Klain, will I be okay after it's over? And he goes, yes, why wouldn't you be? Oh, God. And then he offered me the job. It was for 6 months. The CFO that was currently in place, who became a friend of mine and obviously is a friend of all of ours, but unfortunately, he just wasn't doing a very good job. And bills from 2 or 3 years from the beginning of the administration weren't getting paid. And guess where the bills were outstanding? Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina. You get the picture?
Yes.
Primary states, the first three primary states, and the vice president's office owed money to like rental car companies, hotels. Oh, yeah.
It's ridiculous.
It was horrible. So Ron Klain says, have you ever done an audit before? And of course, I didn't have the guts to tell him the truth. I went to law school because there's no math.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Are we done? Are we over? Oh, my God. We got 6 minutes.
No. I said exactly. No, I hear you.
Yeah. So then I quickly said, of course I can do an audit. Well, keep in mind, we didn't have the internet yet, really, the way we do now. We didn't go just Google, how do you do an audit? And do you know what I had to do? Everything was paper form. Nothing was in databases yet. Everything was in manila folders in chronological order. And every folder had every document from that particular trip where the money was owed. I'd have to wait till the CFO left at 5:30. He left meticulously.
And then I would lock
the door and put a chair under both handles in case he decided to come back.
Oh my God.
Yes, I'd get each folder, get on the ground and spread out. And I don't know, to this day, I could not tell you how I learned to do a spreadsheet. How did I learn to audit the documents?
That's
I don't know.
So funny.
I don't know how I did it, but 6 months came And I presented the audit report covert right, to Ron Klain, and then he gave it to Al Gore. And the day after my 6 months were up, I was packing my bags to go back to agriculture. And I get a phone call, and it was the vice president. And he said, can you come to the West Wing? I'd like to see you before you leave. And I said, of course, Mr. Vice President. And typical Latino, I ran over there, you know. And I went in to see him, and I did what every Latino would do. Sir, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. I am so grateful for that. You've changed my life these 6 months. I would have never had this opportunity. And I'm just going on and on and on and on. And going, thank you, thank you, thank you. And he looked at me and goes, whoa, 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 Mr. Vella. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I said, I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry. I'm just really grateful. He said, I called you over here for a different reason. And I said, oh. I'm sorry, sir. Did I do something wrong? Again, Latino training. Right.
Oh, yes.
He goes, apt to the contrary. He said, I just read your report. And he said, I called you over here because I'd like to know if you'd like to be my next chief financial officer and my senior advisor on Latino and LGBT policies. And so, Diana, that is the longest answer to your question, but that is exactly how it happened right there.
Wow.
Again,
I love it.
I love it. You don't plan it. You don't script it. I believe if we put out good energy, positive energy, do a good job at wherever we're at and whatever we're doing, do your best, then the universe, the Lord, Muhammad, Buddha, the stars, the trees, will your path, as you said earlier, your purpose, your path, your why will come clear. The clarity will occur. We just have to be open to it. I think too many people are not looking and listening. We get so busy in our daily routines and in the status quo that we may be missing, not just in career, but in love and in joy and in happiness and in fulfillment and in contentment. We're missing it. It's passing us by because we're not stopping to pay attention. And that's the lesson I learned from all of that, right? Was just live in the moment. Yes, M-O-E-M-E-N-T. And
those are the best ones.
The good thing is I'm dating a guy named Matt. And now we're going to do a podcast called Moments Matter. Moments Matter. Can you imagine?
Moments Matter. That's funny.
But anyway, that's how that happened. And you know, well, we can always do another part two one day if you guys
will.
We'll talk about from there to the present because believe me, you get to come back a second time and, you know, set up Joe Biden's office as vice president. Sure. That's a whole other set of stories.
Going to Chile
and Costa Rica with him on his first international trip to Latin countries.
Nice.
Yep.
So listeners, did you not get he's amazing? You know, you got to experience a superb moment.
I'm far
and
from
no amazing. Does matter.
No.
Thank you. Because that final takeaway is perfect, right? It's live in the moment, seek the clarity, pick up your head and look around for the love of God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right? And remember, every one of us is worthy. Yes. We're all worthy of love and we're all worthy to be here and we should be at the table. And I love what you said earlier. If there's not a chair for you, bring your own damn chair.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Bring one for a friend too.
Absolutely.
That should be the new mantra.
Yeah, and that's a topic. Will y'all promise me on part two that we will discuss this? This is a very serious issue for me, and it's what I call a pandemic within the Latino community. My entire career, it has been a disease in the Latino community, and it is still a disease in the Latino community. We must talk about it and air our dirty laundry in order to fix it. And that's the issue of Latinos pulling each other down out of jealousy and insecurity. And they don't want to see another Latino succeed because they somehow think that makes them less.
Because we only think there's one role.
Oh, this chaps me. And we're going to talk about it in a part two because this is an issue we must resolve.
So we will come back at part two, and we're going to talk through just the continuation of your political role, how you created these two companies, how you ended up on Unicorn Hunters. We're going to have you describe what the heck is a unicoin.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, I'd love that. That's going to be fun. And there'll be a lot less trauma. So we'll...
So no muchísimas cares, gracias.
A lot more laughter and less trauma. How's that?
Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you.
To y'all, what an amazing hour together. Thank you so much. I'm so proud of both of you. And I don't mean that in a patronizing way. I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
That means so much. Thank you, Mo.
Okay. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Blazing Ember podcast and our journey to empowerment. Look out for more episodes to keep your ember blazing.
Visit blazingember.com where you can connect with us and share your feedback. Hasta pronto.